Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning in the first hour of the show, we'll have another in a kind of informal series that we have been doing this summer, looking at alternative energy. And certainly it is true that the increasing cost of oil and concerns about the supply and whether or not we've gotten to the point where we're just simply not going to be able to find more oil in the future. All of this seems to have led a little greater urgency to the search for alternatives to power vehicles. And this morning, in this part of the show, we'll explore one such alternative, biodiesel. Biodiesel can be made from a wide range of renewable plant sources. It can also be made from recycled cooking oils and animal fats. It's biodegradable, it's non-toxic, and a lot of people believe that it has a significant potential. On the show today, in this first hour, we'll be talking about biodiesel, what it is, how it's produced, and what it can do. And our guest for the program is Greg Paul. He is the author of the book Biodiesel, Growing a New Energy Economy. It's published by Chelsea Green. It's paperback. It's not terribly expensive. And if you'd like to find out more about biodiesel, you can head out to the bookstore and look for the book. Of course, also here on the program, if you have questions, you can call. And I know that Greg will do his best to give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call, you can use the toll-free. Actually, even if somebody might happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Paul, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We have plenty of time to get into the subject in detail, but maybe as a general question, we can start off by talking in kind of general terms about biodiesel. What is biodiesel?
Well, biodiesel is the name of a clean-burning alternative fuel which can be produced from local renewable resources. Contains no petroleum, but it can be blended at any level with petroleum diesel to create a biodiesel blend. It can be used in any compression ignition engine, which refers to diesel engines, with usually with little or no modifications. And it's simple to use, biodegradable, non-toxic, and it's essentially free of sulfur and aromatics. Mm-hmm.
Now, can you just hear one quick question, because you talked about blending it with gasoline.
Mm-hmm. No, diesel fuel.
With diesel fuel.
Yep.
I guess I sort of think about that all as being the same, and of course it's not. Blending it with diesel fuel and putting it in a conventional diesel engine.
Yes.
Is generally the way that it has been used, or you think that it's best to use it as a blend? Can you run a diesel engine on 100% biodiesel?
Yes.
You can.
You can run it on 100% biodiesel, and there are a lot of people in the country who are doing that. The auto manufacturers and engine manufacturers generally don't warrant B100 or 100% pure biodiesel use in their vehicles, although some are beginning to come around in this country to encouraging the use of biodiesel at lower blends, say at a 5% level.
Mm-hmm.
But there are quite a few people who do use 100% pure biodiesel, and in most modern diesel engines, that should not cause any problem at all.
What are the most common proportions if it's going to be blended with diesel fuel?
Mm-hmm. I think the most popular blend in this country at the moment is referred to as B20, or 20% biodiesel mixed with 80% petrodiesel.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of almost an accidental level that was decided on fairly early on in the process of the development of the industry in this country, because biodiesel for many years was much more expensive than petroleum diesel, yet it was felt that with a 20% level you could gain quite a few of the benefits for using biodiesel while not costing too much more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the most popular blend, although there are quite a few other other blends that are out there as low as perhaps B2 or 2% biodiesel. And there are some companies that perhaps are using as much as, say, a B50 blend. It really depends on the situation. But the average biodiesel pump at a filling station these days is probably pumping B20.
Now, around this part of the country, people are used to the idea that we have gasoline that is blended with ethanol.
Yes.
And in most cases, I think we're looking at a E10, which is 10% ethanol, although there are now vehicles that are known as flexible fuel vehicles that can use what it's called a E80, is it 80, 85? Mm-hmm. The one that's mostly more than half ethanol. Although that fuel is limited in its availability, in fact, I think here in Champaign-Urbana, where I live, I don't think you can buy it at all. You can buy it not very far away from here. But one of the perhaps you might consider it a drawback, one of the drawbacks of the higher ethanol blend is that you don't get the same mileage that you do with that you could get with 100% gasoline, or even, I guess, with a 10% or less. I guess there are also some, there's E5 and there's E7, but mostly I think it's what's out there is 10. How does the mileage compare with if you have a conventional 100% petro diesel? How does the mileage compare with what you can get with a blend where you're blending in some biodiesel?
Well, it's a good question. There were some studies that were conducted by various government agencies a number of years ago that tended to indicate that mileage was slightly lower. Biodiesel's energy content is about 10 to 20% lower than petrodiesel. It's something like 121,000 BTUs versus 135,000 BTUs for petrodiesel. But this is partly offset by an increase in combustion efficiency. So the net result is that there's about a 5% decrease in torque and power and fuel efficiency in diesel engines that are running on biodiesel. But most people can't tell the difference at all. And there have been some contradictory results that have been reported fairly recently by some fleets that have been keeping, you know, careful track of how their engines are performing on biodiesel. And some of these fleet results have indicated that they're actually getting better mileage with biodiesel than petrodiesel. So it's really hard to say exactly where that's really at. But I think in general you can say that there's virtually no difference.
What about when you make comparisons in emissions between 100% petrodiesel and the biodiesel? How do they compare?
Mm-hmm. Well, biodiesel is free of lead. Contains virtually no sulfur or aromatics, and it results in substantial reductions in the release of unburned hydrocarbons and carbon monoxide and particulate matter, which have been linked to, say, respiratory diseases, cancer, and other adverse health effects. The production and use of biodiesel results in a 78% reduction in carbon dioxide emissions, according to a USDA DOE study published in 1998, I think it was. So there are substantial reductions in most of the negative types of emissions that would normally be associated with petrodiesel when you're using biodiesel. And the amount of those negative emissions can be reduced proportionately to the amount of biodiesel that's blended with the petrodiesel.
Mm-hmm. So more biodiesel, your emissions are going to go down.
Yes.
Yeah. One thing here, we've been talking a lot about using this in to power a vehicle. It is all biodiesel is also something that could be used for home heating.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And is that a different? Here, I guess you're rather than blending it with the diesel with diesel fuel, you would be blending it with home heating oil?
Number two heating oil.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, in fact, I've been doing that in my own home for the past four heating seasons. It works just fine. Your boiler or furnace can't tell the difference, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly a viable strategy. In fact, number two heating oil is essentially the same as diesel fuel, which is used for on-road vehicles. Hmm. Most people don't realize that, but it's essentially the same thing. So if you're mixing biodiesel with heating oil, it's the same idea as if you were mixing it with fuel for vehicles.
Uh-huh. And as you say, as far as your furnace is concerned, it doesn't make any difference.
Basically, no. There's a couple of caveats about that. That there were some extensive studies that were conducted by a number of government testing agencies that indicated that biodiesel could be blended with number two heating fuel up to about a B30 or 30% biodiesel blend without causing any problems of any kind. Biodiesel, among its many properties, is a fairly strong solvent, and so biodiesel will tend to clean out the gunk that tends to be inside of old fuel tanks and old fuel lines, and that gunk ends up in your fuel filter. And so this is a problem with initial use of biodiesel in any older piece of equipment, whether it's a vehicle or whether it's a boiler or a furnace. And the older the equipment, usually the dirtier the insides of those tanks and fuel lines can be. So you may have to change a fuel filter a few times initially, but that's usually the only problem. The other issue related to using it as a home heating fuel is that, again, because of its high solvent properties, pure B100, if used as a home heating fuel, will eventually soften a small rubber seal that is inside of virtually every fuel pump that's part of the oil burner. And eventually that rubber seal will begin to leak a little bit, and it will have to be replaced. Now, it can be replaced with a synthetic seal like Phyton or Teflon, and that takes care of the problem. And that's really the only major limitation about using higher quantities of biodiesel as a home heating fuel, although there also have been scattered reports of burner shutdowns because the CAD cell inside the oil burner, which is part of the safety equipment, occasionally cannot see the B100 flame because that flame is in a slightly different part of the visible light spectrum from a standard number two heating oil flame. And so the burner thinks that there's been no ignition and it shuts down. It's an occasional problem. It's not consistent, so it's a little hard to say, you know, whether it would be a problem for you or not, but the quick fix for that is to lower the percentage of the amount of biodiesel that you're blending with the number two heating oil, and then that problem should just go away.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Greg Paul. He's been involved with renewable energy issues for more than 20 years. He's a freelance writer and journalist. He's a founding member and co-director of the Vermont Biofuels Association. If you're interested, by the way, in the subject of home heating, he's the author of another book, which is titled Natural Home Heating. You might want to take a look at that. And if you want to read about biodiesel, you can look for the book Biodiesel, Growing a New Energy Economy. It is published by the Chelsea Green Publishing Company. We have a caller, and I expect maybe we'll have some other folks who have questions. You'd like to talk with our guest. You can do that by calling us 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here to start us off in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I imagine in terms of the political terrain, in relationship to the rather large number, after listening to you talk, a rather large number of choices we have for a fuel, could you, say, in the ideal world, take in consideration all the tests that have been done and the release of solvents or whatever, what would be the ideal situation for us to be using in our homes and in our diesel trucks and in our cars versus the political clout of the petroleum industry and what they actually want to be done? Thanks.
Okay. Well, can you do that, Greg?
I'm not sure I entirely understand the question.
Well, I guess the question is, or it goes to this issue of here is an alternative. Here's an alternative to petroleum.
Right.
But we know the kind of clout the petroleum industry has.
Right.
And we know that also people are just we're used to that, and it is a readily available fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be difficult for someone to come along to challenge the oil industry because it's bigger, because it's entrenched, because it had a lot of friends in Washington, because already we have this infrastructure set up to distribute the product. And in fact, there might be biodiesel might be better.
Mm-hmm.
At least it might be good for that alternative to be out there for people to choose it.
Right.
But there are going to be reasons why it's going to have a difficult time challenging petroleum.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly has had difficulty challenging petroleum for many, many years. I mean, the playing field is certainly not level at all when it comes to national fuel policies. Oil, coal, natural gas, and the nuclear industries are heavily subsidized by the federal government. And so for many years, it's been a real uphill struggle for renewable fuels of any kind, and certainly biodiesel has suffered from that disadvantage. It's begun to change somewhat. Within the past year or so, there's been some favorable biodiesel legislation that has been passed. There was a tax credit, in fact, that was passed at the end of the legislative session last year, which has been implemented starting in January of this year. It's still being implemented by the IRS, but in general, that provides about one penny of a refund or rebate for every percentage point of biodiesel that's blended with petroleum-based fuel. So for a B50 blend, for example, it would effectively lower the cost of biodiesel by 50 cents a gallon. And that certainly has made a tremendous difference and has resulted in an awful lot of activity in the biodiesel industry. So the whole political situation certainly is an important one, and I would say that for biodiesel in particular, but even for virtually all renewable energy sources, that the largest barrier to greater acceptance has not been technical, but has been primarily a political problem.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the inertia of the large industries that tend to be resistant to change.
Most of the diesel engines that are on the road today are going to be buses and trucks, although I'm sure that there are some, a much smaller number of passenger vehicles, cars,
mm-hmm.
that run on diesel. How many diesel engines are there out there? And I guess one of the things I'm particularly curious about is how many personal transportation passenger vehicles there are that are run on, they're now running on diesel.
Right. The diesel cars in this country represent a very small proportion of the total vehicle fleet, passenger vehicle fleet. I think it's somewhere between 1% and 3%. In Europe, on the other hand, diesel-powered cars represent somewhere between 40 and I think about 60% of the total passenger vehicle fleet. So you can see that the use of biodiesel could make an enormous difference in Europe as far as passenger cars are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Diesel-powered cars got a bad name in this country back in the 1970s and 80s. There were some less than spectacular diesel-powered cars produced back then. And so people just got the idea that diesels weren't a very good idea for passenger cars. That's changing. And there's been a lot of interest recently, particularly within the last year, about diesel-powered cars. And there's some really nice ones being produced in Europe at the present time. And there's been quite a bit of demand, increased demand for those vehicles, because it's possible to use biodiesel to run them.
Let's talk with someone else. This
sure.
is also someone from Indiana and on our toll-free line.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Thanks for having the subject I've been thinking about for years. this all started. We went back to the Indiana State Fair, and we've seen them driving these soy diesel-powered tractors around for years. And we thought, why isn't this catching on if we can grow this stuff? And I'm thinking, I don't know why the petroleum industry would be against it, because I'm thinking somebody has to blend this, don't they, and distribute it?
Yes. Yes, they do.
Couldn't that be the same companies that already blend the diesel fuels we use now and distribute it through the same channels?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I can't see a downside, and I've looked at this, like I said, off and on for a few years, and I can't figure out what the holdup is. If it's not the petroleum industry, we want to reduce dependence on foreign oil. What politician would look better supporting this?
Mm-hmm. Those are good points. And in fact, biodiesel has been coming on very strong in this country, and its use has been increasing exponentially within the last few years. In 2003, there were approximately 25 million gallons of biodiesel produced in this country. In 2004, that number had risen to 30 million gallons, and by the end of this year, the figure is expected to be around 100 million gallons. So you can see that there's been really substantial growth in the industry, and that's being driven largely by consumer demand. People are realizing that oil is getting more expensive, and future supplies are certainly being questioned at this point. And we certainly need to start looking for alternatives, and so there is a lot of interest and a lot of demand out there. And I think a lot of the barriers to the greater acceptance of biodiesel have been crumbling rather quickly within the last few years.
Every opportunity I get, I talk this up. I guess I'm afraid if it really catches on, I wonder if we're going to have the automotive infrastructure to get the vehicles that people like you and I might want to buy.
Mm-hmm. Well, if people start asking the auto manufacturers to produce appropriate vehicles, I think they will respond.
So is that what you would suggest, the best way to go about it?
Certainly one good way.
One good way. I know the last time I checked here in Indiana, we had two sources for biodiesel in the whole state.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were only in blends of B2 and B10.
Mm-hmm.
And until today, I thought, well, maybe that's the problem. You can only go up to B10 and run in a vehicle. But now I hear you talking about up to B100. So what blends are available to be used in vehicles?
Right.
Can you go to B100?
B100 isn't a blend. It's just straight biodiesel. But, yes, you can. But most of the people in the fuel industry are cautiously adding this to their selection of fuels, and in many cases it does require some additional handling and storage capacity or facilities. If biodiesel is being handled as a blend, it's pretty straightforward, but as soon as you start dealing with straight biodiesel, B100, sometimes it requires slightly different storage and handling, particularly during cold weather, because biodiesel suffers from the same problem that straight diesel does in cold weather, only it suffers a little bit more. So it tends to gel or congeal under extremely cold weather conditions.
Okay, so other than it being biologically produced instead of drilled like oil, does it cost more to produce the biodiesel for a gallon than it does to bring this from overseas, maybe, and refine it ourselves?
Biodiesel traditionally has cost more to produce than petrodiesel, yes.
Okay, so
the costs are coming down somewhat.
Okay. I'm just wondering if they're including the total cost of bringing this oil from halfway around the world and then refining it, as compared to maybe, mm-hmm. Growing the soy product here and
right.
Producing it.
Well, actually, as I mentioned earlier, the petroleum industry and has been heavily subsidized for many, many years. And I think if Americans were actually paying the actual cost of what it really costs to bring the oil here from overseas and refine it and distribute it, we probably would be paying. I don't know what the exact figures. I've heard a number of different figures, but we could easily be paying $5 or $6 a gallon.
Okay. Well, I know I've sent letters to both of the senators over here in Indiana, And I got a response from one saying thank you for your support of ethanol-based fuels, and so I knew he didn't have an idea. And the second one actually said and responded and answered me back and talked about biodiesel. So the first one missed the whole boat completely. I think they stuck it in a file somewhere, said alternative, and I got an answer back. Was talking about corn-based ethanol, but I was specifically addressing, you know, soy-based diesel. So
Right. Maybe
we need to talk more with our elected officials and try to smarten them up.
Mm-hmm. Well, there certainly is that's an important issue that you raise, and that is that a lot of people still don't really know what biodiesel is. And so, you know, part of this whole mission of increasing the use of biodiesel is education, and it's a major component of most of these biodiesel promotional initiatives, just letting people know what it's all about and answering their questions. So, yeah, that's important.
Outstanding. Well, I appreciate your time, and I just wanted to say I think the diesel, you know, is a tried and true technology, so we're not having to invent anything new. This might be the stopgap alternative fuel that we need to get, you know, to hydrogen or something, you know, 20 years down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thanks for your time.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, the caller makes the point of the fact that he had seen biodiesel engines running and was wondering, well, why is it that we're not doing more with this? In fact, one of the things that you point out in the book, where you look a little bit at the history of this, is that more than 100 years ago, the man who invented the diesel engine, Rudolf Diesel, was talking about using vegetable oil as a fuel source.
Yes, it's not a new idea.
It's not a new idea at all.
No. Diesel used a wide variety of fuels in his early experiments. His main idea was to create an engine that could be run on almost any fuel produced almost anywhere. And he did experiment with vegetable oils, although his earliest prototype models actually burned a low-grade kerosene. But in any case, he certainly was a strong proponent of the use of vegetable oil fuels. And it wasn't until later on, when with the growth of the oil industry, petroleum oil industry, where a low-grade petroleum-based fuel, which later became known as diesel fuel, ended up becoming the fuel of choice because it was so much cheaper. And Diesel's engine was modified in later years to burn this cheaper petroleum-based diesel fuel, which caused problems in the, say, the 1970s and early 1980s with the early biodiesel researchers who were trying to figure out ways of using a vegetable oil-based fuel to run modern diesel engines after the oil crises of the 1970s. And a lot of these researchers ruined a lot of modern diesel engines by trying to burn straight vegetable oil in them. And that's because Diesel's engine design had been modified to only use the petrol-based fuel. And so the whole concept of biodiesel was, well, rather than trying to modify all the millions of diesel engines that were out there in the world, it was just going to be easier to modify the fuel. And that's how the whole idea of making biodiesel evolved.
Well, what exactly is the difference between gasoline and diesel, petrol diesel fuel?
Well, they're slightly different fuels based on use in engines with different designs. A diesel engine is a compression ignition engine, which ignites the fuel due to extremely high pressure within the engine, which raises the temperature to a combustion level without the use of a spark plug. In a gasoline engine or an ignition, regular spark ignition engine, which runs on gasoline, the combustion is initiated by a spark from a spark plug. That's the primary difference.
Hmm. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. We have several callers, and we'll continue to talk with people who are listening. Our guest is Greg Paul, and his book, if you'd like to take a look at it, is Biodiesel, Growing a New Energy Economy. It's published by Chelsea Green. It's a paperback. It's not terribly expensive, so you should be able to find it in the bookstore. He is also, by the way, author of another book that you might want to take a look at, which is titled Natural Home Heating. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have several callers here, starting with someone in Chicago, and this is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
How does British Petroleum and Dutch Shell and the people that build all those tankers feel about something like this going into their fabulous profits?
That's a good question. I don't happen to be an insider in any of those companies, but I would say that initially, the major oil companies just tended to ignore biodiesel. It was considered to be a fringe environmental thing that just wasn't worth paying attention to. The views have changed. At one point, some of the major oil companies became rather hostile to the whole idea of biodiesel and were causing a number of legal problems for a number of these biodiesel initiatives, particularly in Europe. More recently, I think most of these big oil companies have come to realize that biodiesel, well, it's an opportunity for them, too. And so the resistance to biodiesel has been crumbling on the part of these companies, and I think many of them are now becoming actively involved with the whole biodiesel movement, particularly in Europe, where biodiesel is a much more mature industry than it is here, and it has been almost entirely integrated into the major petroleum infrastructure at this point. So the biodiesel industry and the petrodiesel industry in Europe are now working hand in hand.
I heard the other day on ethanol, it takes more energy to create ethanol than it saves. And is that a myth, or is that something that oil companies are pushing?
Well, that's a good question. Right. I think you're probably referring to the recent biofuel study by Cornell researcher David Pimentel and Ted Putz. Patzek, I believe, of the University of California in Berkeley. The study that has gotten, that particular study has gotten an awful lot of press coverage in the last few weeks in this country, and unfortunately, the study is deeply flawed. I don't think we have time to go through all the reasons why it's so deeply flawed. But you've heard the old saying about garbage in, garbage out.
Right.
Well. You don't need to manipulate too many statistics in order to come up with some fairly outlandish conclusions, and that seems to be the general situation with that study. It's been widely discredited by a large number of people who know what they're talking about.
How does our governor feel about that?
About what?
About the biodiesel and ethanol. Is he apathetic, or does he care?
I'm sorry.
Would he push that? Governor Blagojevich.
I don't live in your state, so I don't know for sure, but I understand that he's been fairly supportive.
Well, I had a diesel car 40 years ago, and the problem was it was kind of noisy and a little difficult to start in the wintertime, and the problem was trying to find a station that sold the fuel.
Right.
Outside of that, there's no problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, modern diesel cars are much quieter.
Right.
Run much better, generally speaking, just have been vastly improved. And the new, some of the new models from Europe, Volkswagen and so on, are really wonderful vehicles.
There you go.
And,
is that true that a compression ignition engine like that will run on anything that will explode? I remember 50, 60 years ago, they ran a diesel train on powdered milk and powdered coal and anything that would explode under a compression.
Well,
is that possible?
Theoretically, yes.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't recommend putting milk into your diesel engine.
But you can get it down to a fine dust, and it'll explode.
I mean, that was the whole idea behind Rudolf Diesel's original engine design. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go on here to another caller, and that would be someone here in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I understand that Pimentel's arguments are basically have to do with cost accounting in a way. He looks at he takes in a broader range of all the inputs involved than most of the studies that are out there. And since we're talking about cost accounting, that's definitely foreign territory for most of the scientists out there. So I'm not, and also it's at the core of one of the things he's pointing at is the fact that you can only get about 77,000 BTUs per gallon out of ethanol when gasoline is up at least at 110,000. So they, you know, but I was curious to know if in your creation of this book that you got into two different areas. One is that I know that a lot of people are worried that biodiesel might cause a lot of shifts in terms of international power, political power, and that in our neck of the woods, Brazil is a big source of worry, I suppose. And I read recently that, for example, that in Technology Review that Brazil is the largest producer of fuel ethanol in the world, and it has an export potential of 10 billion liters per year. So I'm kind of wondering if you know anything. Can you put our efforts vis-a-vis against Brazil's? And then number two, I was wondering if you knew anything about Stephen Chu's efforts at creating ethanol by following what termites do. Now I'll hang up.
Okay, I don't claim to be an ethanol expert since my book really isn't on ethanol, so I can't speak too much about that. As far as foreign producers of biodiesel are concerned, I mean, I don't see them as being a problem. I think there's one thing that we haven't really discussed yet, and it's important to understand, and that's that even under the best circumstances, we're probably not talking about biodiesel being able to replace more than about perhaps 10 or 15% of our current consumption of petrodiesel. And so I would say that virtually any country that's involved in the production of biodiesel is going to be using virtually all of it locally, and that there isn't going to be an awful lot of biodiesel being exported around the world, although I think there has been some of that at various times. So I think that the biodiesel that's going to be produced here in this country is, generally speaking, going to stay here, and I think the same can largely be said for most other countries, although there's been such an incredible demand for biodiesel in Europe that they have been importing some from other countries.
Well, so I guess I wonder if there would be some people who would make the argument that, well, I suppose on one side, some people make the argument that anything that reduces our dependence on oil is good, and if we're moving to a fuel that has a kinder environmental impact, that's good. Would there be people on the other side who would say that it would make such a small dent, though, in our dependence on oil that that's somehow not quite worth it?
Well, I think anything that helps to reduce our over-dependence on oil is definitely worth it. And I guess the other thing that people need to understand about biodiesel and virtually all renewable fuel strategies is that we're going to be relying in the future, as we move ahead here, we're going to be relying on a much broader array of fuels and fuel sources than we do presently. They're probably going to be more expensive, and it's going to require putting together a large and diverse strategy of different fuels in order to even come close to meeting our needs. And I think people need to start thinking realistically about the fact that we may very well be coming into a period in the future here where we're talking about reductions, serious reductions in consumption. Mm-hmm. And people need to really give that some thought.
I want to get in. We have some more callers.
Sure.
I want to try and get in as many people as I can. But, you know, we've been talking all this time, and I'm just now sitting here thinking that I haven't asked you to talk at all about how biodiesel is produced.
Mm-hmm.
And where it comes from.
Right.
Just maybe I'd better at least give you a couple of minutes to talk about exactly. You know, we've talked about it a number of ways here, but we
right.
really haven't asked the basic question about where it comes from.
Okay. Well, biodiesel can be made from a wide range of sources. Virtually any vegetable oil that you can think of will work. It can be corn oil, it can be cottonseed oil, it can be soy, canola, rapeseed, and it can also be made from animal fats, and it can also be made from what amounts to pond algae. So there's a wide range of sources, and the process is actually fairly simple. The chemical process is called transesterification, and it's in which the glycerin content of the vegetable oil is separated from the vegetable oil. And this lowers the viscosity of the vegetable oil so that it will flow through and properly combust in a modern diesel engine. The process is accomplished by mixing carefully measured amounts of alcohol, which is usually methanol or ethanol, with a catalyst, which is usually sodium hydroxide or potassium hydroxide, and that's then mixed with the vegetable oil. It's usually stirred up, and it's often heated to hasten the process. And the catalyst initiates the reaction between the vegetable oil and the alcohol. And the process leaves behind two products, alkyl esters, which is the generic chemical name for biodiesel, and glycerin, which is a byproduct, which is usually sold for use in soaps or pharmaceuticals or other products. And that's it. It's really fairly straightforward, and in the large-scale biodiesel, commercial-scale biodiesel plants, they use the same general procedure, only it's much more sophisticated.
All right. Well, let's talk with some other people who are here listening, and the next is in Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Two questions. What you've been discussing and the relationship between the plant life and human food, I wonder, is that assumption correct that that ethanol or the ingredients in ethanol come from necessarily products could be used for human consumption and are, in some cases, the oils that you mentioned?
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yes.
All right. Then that leads to my next question. What about the priorities between human food and somebody traveling around on four wheels?
Yep.
So it seems to be at odds, in my view. And then the second question would be the byproducts. You know, if we really think of internal combustion engines and the magnitude of those things around the world, we have virtually upon this planet, a raging fire. You know, not only the natural occurring fires, volcanoes and forest fires, which are brought on by some other things, but we have a constant burning process that is throwing pollutants up into the air. And can this be sustained into perpetuity?
Mm-hmm. Two excellent questions. I'll try to answer the food versus fuel question first. In Europe, virtually all of the biodiesel is produced from what's called rapeseed. It's a canola. And that those crops, which are considered to be industrial oil crops, are grown on what is referred to as set-aside land. And this is land which has been deliberately taken out of food production and can only be used for other purposes. And so the biodiesel feedstocks that are being grown in Europe are not directly competing with food production. In the United States and in other countries around the world where there is a growing biodiesel industry as well, they are in many of these strategies in these other countries like India and South Africa are going to be using crops which grow on degraded lands or lands which are not presently being used for food production. And some of these crops, these plants, one of them is called Jatropha, actually stabilizes marginal lands and helps to improve the quality of the soils. So in those strategies, again, the biodiesel production is not directly competing for food, but it's a legitimate concern, and I think that it's something that we all need to consider when we're looking at these various strategies.
And then the pollution question.
Mm-hmm. Well, the use of biodiesel in terms of combustion, I mean, an internal combustion engine produces pollutants, period. I agree with that. The advantage of biodiesel is that it substantially reduces those pollutants. And so anything, in my view, anything that reduces those pollutants is certainly worth seriously taking a look at.
And the pollutants that do accrue out of the tailpipe, mm-hmm. and what effect do they have upon the environment?
Well, again, the lower the negative emissions, the better the effect. B100 straight biodiesel substantially reduces most of those.
As opposed to the petrol.
As opposed to the petrol diesel, yes.
Yes. Yesterday I witnessed a piece of heavy equipment with petrol diesel.
Yes.
And it looked like a steam train.
Yes.
Under stress.
Yes.
And it was just.
And that particular piece of equipment was probably not properly tuned to begin with.
Well,
but if that same piece of equipment had been running on B100, you probably would have not seen any visible exhaust at all.
But the results of the burning is not very nice to the human lung.
That's true. Absolutely.
Yes, and any air breathing, most life on Earth commands, you know, some either the intake of carbon dioxide and oxygen.
Yes.
And whenever we do things that interrupt that cycle, then I think that's all negative.
Mm-hmm. We do have to remember, however, that the international economy essentially functions on diesel engines.
Yeah, there's
that. Without them, the global economy would grind to a halt.
Yes, well, there's the problem. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
You're
for
welcome.
The call. Let's go and see if we can get at least one more. We'll go to a caller here in Atlanta, Illinois, line 3. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Interesting conversation. I think the guest is exactly right. We're going to have to change our way of doing things to a more conservative way to make this whole thing work. But being a farmer and having followed biodiesel for quite a few years now, you know, everything I've read indicates that more energy is used to create biodiesel and then you get out of it, which if you think about the production alone of moving the fertilizers, mining the fertilizers, the petrochemicals for the chemicals to spray the beans or whatever, rape or whatever we're using here, you know, it's going to add up to be quite a bit of energy to grow, to make some energy. So the other callers, the last three callers, has kind of touched on the same thing, so I'm just being repetitive. The other thing that I was going to ask was on land usage. You know, set-aside here in this country is set-aside for other reasons of wildlife and land erosion, which you did touch on, that maybe there is certain crops that could reduce land erosion. But, you know, in this country, the set-aside philosophy is not like in Europe. So, you know, growing those things on set-aside ground would, you know, ruin the whole set-aside program as far as its intent. So if you really move to a biodiesel economy and what percentage, if you know, due to necessity, because there isn't any oil, that we had to go to a 50% biodiesel economy as far as fuel usage. What percentage of land, can you imagine the amount of land that it would take to grow those crops that would be taken out of the food supply system, just like the other person talked about, because, you know, there's more and more pressure on our food supply now as populations go up. So these questions have already been asked, but I just stayed on the phone anyway, and
yeah.
I'll ask again.
Well, and I appreciate the questions, and unfortunately I can give the guest about a minute. I don't know how, Greg, if you want to respond to some of what the caller had to say or can.
Well, the food versus fuel question is a legitimate one, and it's one which we're going to have to consider as we move forward here. And I think you touched on one possible, in fact, probable scenario here, and that is that as petroleum becomes more and more expensive and less available, we're going to be forced to make a lot of tough fuel choices. And I think you need to look at all of the advantages from the particular strategy that you're looking at, and then look at all the disadvantages and try to make up your mind what the best decision is. And, you know, we've wasted the last 30 years when we could have made this transition easily from the petroleum-based economy to a renewably-based economy. That didn't happen, and now we're faced with a situation where we're going to have to make a group of increasingly unattractive choices. And that's the reality that we face, and people just need to get used to that.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. If you're interested in finding out more about this subject, look for the book I mentioned a couple of times. It's titled Biodiesel, Growing a New Energy Economy, published by Chelsea Green, by our guest, Greg Paul. He has been interested in renewable energy for a long time. He's a founding member and co-director of the Vermont Biofuels Association, also author of another book that you might find interesting. That book is titled Natural Home Heating. Mr. Paul, thanks very much.
You're most welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Our show, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Infant Parent Institute, with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information available on the web at infantparent.com. Thanks to you, we're pleased to announce that we surpassed our fiscal year 2005 listener support goal. Listener contributions to WILL Radio over the past year total $886,000. That's about $38,000 more than our goal. These additional dollars will help us maintain important core programs and services in the face of increasing costs of doing business and continued uncertainty in government support. Thanks again from all of us here at WILL for making a difference in the community. We will take a break for news and a market update. When we continue, we'll be talking about what's going on these days in organized labor. Our guest will be Bob Bruno from the Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations here at the U of I. First, though, we'll break for an update on the market.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his